This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Where are the most simple solutions I can solve quickly?
Because Harleys, ever since I've grown up, I have been desirous of owning a Harley, but I wouldn't spend less.
Continuously encourage people to pay for my product.
There's no such person as Jesus. It's all made up.
It is Wednesday, the 20th of December, and my God, it's almost Christmas. Santa is almost making a beeline down your chimneys, hopefully bringing you lots of presents and all the things that you've wanted this year. Now, this is the very last episode before Christmas, and we'll have one Christmas week, which will hopefully be show number 11. But this one, we have an interview with the absolutely fabulous Annie Parker, who is the CEO of a place called Fish Burners in Sydney. It's also in Brisbane and throughout Southeast Asia as well. Fish Burners, Shanghai, sorry, in China. Fish Burners is a community of tech startups. Now, she's going to tell you all about it, so I'm not going to even begin to describe it, but it is a fascinating conversation. And even if you're not a startup, even if you've been in business for a long time, I think Annie's wisdom and ideas will give you something to think about. So Annie Parker is our full interview today. But before we do that, let's go and check in with the guys at the Spin Cycle and see how they are. Welcome to another edition of the Spin Cycle. And with me, as usual, is the Jeff Bezos of co-hosts, Edwina Luck, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT. And also with me is the Frank Walker of co-hosts, Patrick Condren.
I know who neither of those people are.
Oh, you must know who Frank Walker is.
Yes, you do know who
Who's Frank Walker?
Oh, he's the tile man.
Hello. Hello, I'm Frank Walker from National Tiles.
Hello.
And that band from Perth made a song about from the music of
I do beg your pardon, but whenever Frank Walker comes on the wireless, particularly when Maddie and I are driving either to rowing at Sparrow Fart or swimming at Sparrow Fart, she immediately hits the changes the station and says, yeah, it's too early in the morning for you, Frank.
It's too early for Frank Walker.
And then when he comes on in the afternoon when we're returning from aforementioned sporting events, she says, it's too late in the day for you, Frank.
She knows it.
Well, anyway, Jeff
it's
Bezos
a great ad.
Is
it's a
the,
terrific ad. It's a terrific
it's not,
ad because
it's a terrible ad. It's a terrible
it,
ad.
It's a terrific ad in terms of if you say Frank Walker to just about anyone but me, they're going to know
true.
What you're talking about.
Yeah, that's
and that is actually memorable. Frank Walker doing the ad.
Oh no, we know. Yeah, I am.
Oh right, I will stick it up your bum then.
No.
Not today.
Spoke to a reporter once from Fairfax who actually tried to interview Frank Walker because he'd been named the year's worst ad or something like that. Mm. And they tried to interview him and he got very defensive and he got very upset and he believes that his ads are good and effective.
I think
they're effective. I don't think they're very good.
But, you know, he's still around. He's selling tiles and I must admit I haven't heard him on the radio.
Maybe he's just having a break.
Oh, well, you've not been listening at the correct time.
Anyway, Jeff Bezos is the boss of Amazon and he's worth $100 billion. And I think we mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, hence the contrast between Jeff Bezos and Frank Walker when comparing you two.
I love it.
Wow. That is hurtful on any number of levels. But anyway.
I'm going to talk about Harley Davidson today. So I just want to ask you both, what do you think of what comes to mind when I say those two words, Harley Davidson?
1350 belt drive panhead.
Beautifully,
right, Edwina?
Beautifully crafted purring machine that when I grow out of my scooter, I'd like to own.
Okay. For me, it would have been Sons of Anarchy because I think they all wore they all drove Harleys and things like that. You know, that kind of motorcycle. I think you ride a Harley,
you don't drive one. But anyway,
well, yeah,
it's your show.
Semantics.
You can tell I'm not a motorcycle enthusiast.
Mm.
But I saw on the back of a bus the other day an advert for Harley Davidson. The campaign was called Beat the City, and it had a couple of pictures of two guys on a bike going through a tunnel. And I looked at the website, and what has perhaps surprised me is that Harley Davidson always had a particular image, and they always stuck to that image. It was the carefree motorcyclist. It was a motorcycle enthusiast. It was a kind of a bit of a rebellious streak, that sort of thing.
Very much so, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And now what they're doing is they're advertising for what I would understand to be lower priced end models for you to go and beat the traffic in the city.
They're doing the Porsche from years ago.
What did Porsche do years ago?
They did exactly the same thing. If this is what Harley's doing, they created a model. It was based on the 911, my apologies, and they kind of wanted to have more sales. They didn't realise the prestige brand perception that if you own a Porsche or if you own a Harley, you know, you're in the special club. You belong to this really special community. And so they brought out a new Porsche, which was much cheaper. And, of course, people went, oh, this is great. But, of course, the original Porsche owners went, excuse me, you are devaluing my car. I don't want to belong to that club anymore. I don't want to be part of this community. You don't know what I stand for anymore. And, this is interesting.
So that's why my question to you guys is, do you think it devalues the brand that they start selling budget versions of what is a classic American brand?
Yes, absolutely, without fear of contradiction. Everything that Eddie said about Porsches, but with Harley Davidson, absolutely. If it's like what happened to flying when they opened the Qantas lounge to fly-in, fly-out miners.
Right.
The place is full of high-vis and butt cracks. And it has taken the prestige away from the Qantas Club. Blokes on the piss at 8 o'clock in the morning is not what I would suggest is the Qantas Club is all about. And if every Tom, Dick and Harry can ride a Harley because, as you say, Simon, there is a cheaper version out now, then that absolutely devalues the brand. Because Harleys, ever since I've grown up, I have been desirous of owning a Harley, but I wouldn't spend less to own one. And I think it does devalue the brand.
And you know, like when you I'm looking at the website now, Simon, and I mean, you imagine and envisage the Harleys, you're sitting back, the fat boys, you're resting.
Wow, okay, Simon's put on a bit of weight, but I mean, there's no need to go down that road.
This is why I start the episode like I start it every week.
Might change now. No, I'm not talking about Simon, okay? And I'm looking at this bike.
Are you two in the same room?
It is beautiful, but it's not the Harley that I have perceived in my mind.
It's not the Harley image, yeah.
No. And look, they obviously are saving costs possibly, but to save costs doesn't mean that your new target audience are going to be loyal to you like your old loyal target audience have been. You know, they own the shoes, they go on holidays together, they drive, they have their own little clubs. It's a really big, big cult.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, I mean, I saw this on the back of the bus and I thought, I mean, first off, I thought that was a strange place. I mean, it's not a strange place to be advertising motorcycles because you're stuck behind a bus.
But
I would have thought, I think I know where you're heading, Simon, and I apologise if I've cut you off.
No, go on.
But why would you need to advertise Harley Davidson on the back of a bus?
Absolutely.
So the point is, it has its, and the three of us have different images of what Harley Davidson is, But why do you need to advertise it on the back of a bus?
And we still, and despite the fact that we all have three different images of Harley, we all accept and accept that they are a premium brand, that they are the classic thing for me would be if anyone asked how much a Harley is, and it's that case is if you have to ask, you can't afford one.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very true. There's two other factors. One, the back of a bus, usually you're going to see those on very popular routes, whether it's in the city. It's a really cost-effective mode of advertising. I mean, really amazing medium. And I think in Brisbane CBD, it's about $500 for the back, and a wraparound the bus is not that much more. Yeah. So very cost-effective. However, you know, I ride a scooter, and the popularity and the growth of the scooter market, and I'm not comparing Harleys to scooters, but they've probably said, hey, we want to get in on this. Every other brand is having a cheaper models. People are getting in on it. Let's do this. So they're not sticking to their core audience. They're moving, and it could really damage their brand. Or
it could open their brand up to a whole new audience and a whole new crowd.
It could.
And obviously they've made this decision consciously.
Yeah.
Because they need to make more money.
Yeah.
It's got to be a financial decision to try and, you know, not enough people are buying the high end Harley Davidsons that we, you know, the sports glides and all the extras with all the extras, etc.
I just think surely there's a better way. I mean,
totally.
Rather than devalue the brand and produce a lower quality or a lower priced model, I agree.
You value add and you get your community and your loyal customers who will love you till they, you know, till the end. Maybe.
Yeah. Dying a nasty motorbike accident?
No, they probably own a few different models as well. Yeah. It's not about money. Yes, you've got to have bottom line to go forward. You've got to pay your employees, all that sort of stuff. But look at your core audience before you diversify into another target audience that is really going to eat into your brand.
Do you know one of the things I think that would be a different way of these guys reaching out to people is obviously there's a lot of space in shopping centers. And I don't know if you know, in your local shopping center, you've started to see that some of the car dealerships are sort of taking up that blank, that empty space where they obviously can't find a retailer to fit in there straight away. It would just make more sense for me for these guys to take the brand and put it in front of uninitiated people rather than use price and discount models to sell more product.
Well, so, they do this in Europe.
Anyway,
I
can understand that there's pressures on sales and pressures on, you know, profit and turnover and all those kind of things. But I don't. It just struck me as a weird thing to do and probably the wrong thing to do. So,
I was just thinking, you know, it's a cult. You've got art.
Yeah.
I agree with your concept store. They're doing it in Europe. You get people in there every night. You serve them coffee or wine. You say, hey, sign up. Go for a ride on this bike.
Yeah.
Upsell. Create new customers that way rather than, downgrade. So, sorry. Yeah.
Anyway, you guys wanted to talk about Christmas as well. We're obviously only... Blimey, how far away? 2 weeks away. Less than 2 weeks away.
Less than 13
days.
Oh, who's counting? Santa's on his way.
But you guys wanted
nothing
to talk.
Nothing too expensive for me, Simon.
Oh, dear. I better take it back then, didn't I? Yeah.
What's your favourite Christmas ad at the moment?
I hate Christmas ads in Australia. Christmas ads in Australia.
Why?
Because the vast majority of them are taken from the Northern Hemisphere. And my social media feeds are all full of friends who are in the Northern Hemisphere, in London and in Europe and even in New York where it's snowing. And you've got these, why can't we have advertisers pitching to an Australian audience? Is it because all the ads are made in the Northern Hemisphere, so we've just got to suck it up? And for years and years and years, we've had to sit through at my parents' house, hot roast turkey on a 42-degree day. It is beyond ridiculous. Why can't we have
a
specific Australian Christmas sad.
I think you must be missing them because that's all I see. I, you know, people having barbecues and eating seafood and prawns and.
But if you go to the malls and you look at Santa, he's head to tail in this big heavy outfit.
Shouldn't he
have a pair of board shorts and a Jackie Howe singlet on?
I was just going to say red fur-lined budgie smugglers.
Correct. Absolutely. Mind you, he might never get out of the dressing room with the fur-lined we don't want to get down that road.
There have been some really good Christmas cards that are very Australian or New Zealander, if you want to go then, and with Santa in his boardies on a surfboard, in the sun on the beach, that sort of stuff.
But that's a Christmas card.
Yeah,
I'm talking about billboards and high visibility Christmas cheer advertising. And that's the other thing that irks me about Christmas time. All this emphasis on having a good time. So you're a loser if you don't have a good time. And yet at this time of the year, suicide rates are through the roof. Domestic violence is through the roof. It is such a con.
Well, let's take it back to what most listeners would know, sort of when Jesus' birth, Christianity, in the manger, it was snowing. But even if we go
back...
Was
it snowing at Jesus' birth?
How do you know?
Of course it was.
Were you
it's
there?
Affected. There's no such person as Jesus. It's all made up.
Oh, God, no, the complaints are going to roll in now.
Anywho, so if we even go back... the Europeans celebrated the winter solstice.
Correct.
Solstice, my apologies. And they celebrated that around December 21st to January, and it was, you know, a celebration of fire and feasting. Even before that, the Germans honoured a pagan god. The Romans, they just had a great time celebrating whoever they were, really wanted to.
Raping, pillaging.
Mirthra. No, there was lots. And then Oliver Cromwell actually cancelled Christmas in the 1600s, and in Boston, Christmas was outlawed, so there was not even a Santa around. But what am I getting to? Coca-Cola, of course.
I don't know, but I wish you'd get there.
Yeah, I'm getting there. Coca-Cola created the big fat red Santa with the beard in the 1920s, and that's when it was snowing. Okay, maybe he was drinking it in Coca-Cola on the beach in his far too many, you know, his clothes. But, you know, there's a tradition of Santa in the snow, movies that we've been, you know, that we've grown up with and even our kids now. It's always America. It's always snowing. So there's that history that we've grown up with.
Yes, I understand that.
Yes.
But what my point is, why can't we change or amend the traditional Christmas, which has no place in Australia because it doesn't snow on Christmas Day in Australia.
It's very hot.
Yeah. What?
It's very hot.
Thank you very much.
So I'm not really going to say.
No, the temperature's hot. I thought you were saying I was very hot. The thing, and I think if you came up with a clever campaign around an Australian Christmas, that would pay dividends for your organisation.
I still have got no idea what TV you're watching because I see them all the time.
I do beg your pardon. It's not television advertising that I'm looking at.
Right.
It's billboard advertising. Okay. It's the stuff in the newspapers.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these pictures of snow falling across the pages advertising board shorts.
I think the reason for that is because billboards, print magazines, print newspapers, those kind of things, it's harder to tell a story. It's harder to communicate but you've got less time in which to communicate a story and a message. And I think with print media and billboards, they go for the easy, quick win, which is normally, here's a traditional winter scene, Christmas scene that everybody's
Yeah.
I get your point to say they should be able to do something smarter and more intelligent, but, you know.
They can't be asked.
No, they can be. And you know what?
We
in New Zealand, we're a small population compared to the rest of the world. However, Air New Zealand last year came up with, and they're amazing at their campaigns. If you would remember, you know, their safety videos, the Hobbits, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Their Christmas ad this year is hilarious. And yes, they do look at Santa. There's no snow anywhere to be seen, Pat, so you would be very, very happy. You must go online or go to my blog and watch it. They focus on the vowels that New Zealanders, we always mess up. However,
yes.
2016, chumps, they got Ronan Keating and a very famous child actor, Julian someone, and who's obviously not so famous for me, but he is, and they basically changed the whole song that Ronan was singing to a summer wonderland, and it was really clever. You know, that it wasn't the snow is glistening; it was their bro is glistening because they were sweating. Yeah. It wasn't the bluebird singing; it was the brown bird being the kiwi bird. So it was very, very clever, and you really have to go online to see that one. It's hilarious.
See, it's the kiwis again with this good advertising.
Absolutely, they're much cleverer than us.
Well, cleverer. I don't know about that, but maybe they just care more.
Well, what about that? There was a police recruitment video that I saw recently from New Zealand, which was clever as anything. It was clever enough to be done by me.
Yeah.
That's also, I did write about that one on my blog as well. But look,
and we also.
Gee, she's plugging a blog a bit here, Simon. What's going on?
I never have before, though. Well, because I love Christmas.
You're catching and making up for lost time.
I ought to charge some sort of advertising rates here. Really.
Well, triple the fee that you pay for doing this.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Anyway, it's next week is the last. It'll be the last one of the year. So I think we ought to do something special for that. So I think we ought to perhaps.
Should we do it in the nude?
Let's not do it that special. But maybe we'll.
I do
come
it in the nude.
I
do it in the nude every week.
Yeah.
See, no one can see me.
Well, what we might do then is live stream you doing the podcast next
in
week.
In his Santa suit? In his Santa budgie suit?
I'm fairly
smuggles?
Comfortable. That will be the end of your political career. Anyway.
I'm not a politician.
Your political reporting career.
Career, yes. Anyway. Although I have threatened, I think if One Nation, I was very keen on One Nation getting the balance of power because I said before the election on air that if One Nation got the balance of power, I would stand nude in the Queen Street Mall.
That's where everyone voted against.
People didn't want Pauline Hanson's team to win for two reasons.
Correct.
Anyway, thank you very much, guys. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, again, Simon. As always. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Huzzah.
Bye.
So I am here with Annie Parker, who is the CEO of Fishburners. Now, for people who don't know what Fishburners is, Annie, do you want to give us a quick kind of 2 minutes about what you actually do?
Sure. So Fishburners is Australia's first co-working space. So we started in 2011, and our remit is basically to help any person who's got that crazy-ass idea of, hey, I've got this cool concept of how I'm going to change a business or how I'm going to innovate in a certain area. I actually don't know how to turn it into a business, though, so I need some help on how to start. Where you start with a new business idea, particularly if it's something to do with technology and software, Fishburners is that place to start. So we've got a co-working space in Sydney, one in Brisbane, and one in Shanghai over in China as well. And basically, what we do is we house all of those amazing founders and try and help them figure out how to turn that crazy idea they've had into a business.
I bet it's total anarchy in there most of the time, isn't it?
There's a healthy balance of anarchy and getting stuff done. You're going to get a lot of people who've, you know, sort of, like I said, they've got the crazy idea. Yeah. But a crazy idea doesn't necessarily attract investors or customers. So you have to help them understand how they can turn that into something that's a solvent, you know, kind of something that they can put in front of a customer or an investor and turn it into a business. Because a crazy idea is one thing, but a business is something else.
Do you find that, this is going to sound a really stupid question, but the people that walk into the Sydney offices must obviously differ wildly to the people that walk into the Shanghai offices?
Actually, no, they don't. Okay. They don't differ at all. And I can give you that answer, not necessarily just from an Australia and a China angle, but As my accent might belie, I'm English. I'm sorry about that. I do apologise.
Sorry, I have to apologise as well.
Well, yeah, there you go. Yeah, but we're all in the same boat together, right? I've been working in the startup space for about 7 or 8 years now. And whether or not you're in China, Germany, Ireland, the UK, Australia, every founder who's starting out has the same problem. And that same problem is not just how do I kind of get my crazy idea out of my brain and turn it into a business, but how do I make it so that it becomes a repeatable process such that I can continuously encourage people to pay for my product?
Yeah.
Whether or not you're in China, Germany, Israel, the US, or Australia is actually no different whatsoever. So I know that it's kind of interesting to talk about differences globally between different kind of countries. I'd say 90% of the problems that startups face are the same the world over.
It's funny because one of my second guests was the former editor of Marketing Magazine, a guy called Peter Roper, and he spent a lot of time in China and he teaching out there, and he remarked that the education system between China and Australia was vastly different. But it's interesting that when they get to that startup phase, then that there's obviously a lot of similarities between the cultures and the problems that they face.
Pretty much, and look, there's always going to be differences. Of course, there are. No one's going to try and say that no matter where you come from, you're always going to have exactly the same problems. It's not a 100% analogy. But the analogy of a startup is that it's going to be hard because you are creating something new. By the very definition of that, it's not been done before. Even if it's not been done before globally, it's probably not necessarily been done before in the context that the founder is trying to launch it within. So if you take that concept of what I'm doing is new, by the definition of new, it means there's no real understanding or process of how to do it. So you kind of just have to accept that as founders, you're all breaching into the unknown. You're all doing something a little bit differently. So there's no process for that. No one's got the right answer. So you have to make it up as you go along.
Yeah.
And as exciting as that is, and as motivating as that is, it's also quite kind of disconcerting as well, because there's no right answer.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. I mean, I've started, two or three businesses in the last sort of 7 or 8 years, and it's, and I wouldn't class them as tech startups or anything like that, but it's terrifying. And I look back on it today and I just go, what was I thinking? And all the stuff I know now that I didn't know, 10 years ago, it's hard. It really is hard for people.
Of course it is. And it's not for everybody, and that's okay, right? You need to take into account the decision that you're making as a founder, whether you're starting a people agency or you're manufacturing something, or whether it's a tech startup. By the definition of you doing something new that doesn't have a rule book and doesn't have a Bible of how you do whatever it is that you're about to try and venture out to do, the word venture is an adventure by the definition of the word, right? So it's going to be different. No one has the rule book for it. So be prepared for the unknown and be prepared for it to be hard, but also be prepared for it to be completely exciting and overwhelming and incredibly cool at the same time. You don't get the incredibly cool and the overwhelming without a bit of heartache.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit more about that whole mindset and some of the lessons you've learned over the past years a little bit later. I just want to take a step back to Manchester University. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I'll be completely honest, I never actually had a night out in Manchester. But everybody tells me it's a big night out.
Manchester, as a university student, it's got about 5 universities within a very, very short or small catchment area. That's a lot of students. You are going to have a good time no matter whether or not you plan for it. It's one of those beautiful cities where it's really, really cool. It's a good northern city, lots and lots of Manchester spirit of people just wanting to make sure that you're okay and you take care of others. But at the same time, you're in this massive melting pot of cultures and backgrounds and It's so much fun.
What was going on back in, I know this is going to sound a horrible question in terms of how old you are, because, you know, if I asked you when you were there, that's going to kind of give it away.
No, really, I don't mind. I'm 41 years old, so it's 20 odd years since I was there.
Because I was at university, so I'm 44, so I'm 3 years probably ahead of you. So what would have been going on in Manchester back then? What was the...
So it was the height of the Hacienda, almost on the back end of the Hacienda, actually. So yes, you've got that massive Manchester kind of vibe, crazy kind of Britpop. Yeah. But at the same time, there was the undercurrent of a huge gay and lesbian scene. Huge. Like, if you were a gay or lesbian person going to university, you went to Manchester because of that. It was the place that you would call home. So I went in my first year of uni. I think at least three of the girls on my floor came out as gay when they first got there. And I loved that. I thought that was amazing that they felt so liberated that they could... Yeah, finally admit who they were and what made them comfortable and what made them who they were. I mean, I'm not gay, but I'm massively affiliated to people genuinely embracing what made them who they were.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, no matter who I am now, at the age of 41, I consider that to be a huge tenet to my own personal being. So that was a huge part of my first sort of foray into university, was realizing that people went to uni to figure out who they were, or to embrace or have the opportunity to embrace who they might be. So there's that part of it. And then there was this weird extra part for me where I believe it or not, decided that I would enlist in the British Army.
Oh, wow.
So, I know, right? It's a ridiculous thing to go and do. And I'm 5'1", right? So I'm not what you would call army build. But I went into what was the Territorial Army. So they had this wing or unit within the Territorial Army that was specifically designed for people that were at university, so potentially going to become future leaders.
Yeah.
So we were trained to be officers.
So yeah, I was very aware of, we had people, I knew some people at Southampton University who did the air cadets version of that, of the army thing that you were doing. So they were in the Air Force one. Yeah.
So it's one of those sorts of things where I had no idea or no understanding or even thought process of that's what I might do while I was at uni. And I remember I went into Freshers' Fair and wandered around, you know, all the different folks going, join our club. And there was this group of folks who just looked totally chill with the world. And they'd got lots of photographs behind them of, you know, on rafting and whitewater rafting and climbing. And I went over and I had a chat to them, and they just said, oh yeah, we're part of the Officer Training Corps. It's a part of the Territorial Army, and it's something that, you know, it's paid for. And if you get selected to be part of it, you know, you'll get a wage and a salary, but at the same time, you know, you're going to have to do some pretty interesting things, like, you know, being quite active at weekends and doing some other stuff outside of your course. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'd like to do something that was outside of my course anyway. And one of the girls I'd bumped into at uni, we both went down and did the selection weekend, and it was hardcore. We ended up doing, can you remember a show called, it was one of those ones where at the end of it, they did an assault course.
Yeah. What was that?
Oh, I can't remember what it's called now. And there were loads of quizzes all the way through. So it was lots of intellectual quizzes and all that kind of stuff. And at the end of it, they had to do this hardcore assault course. Well, that assault course was actually the assault course on this army intake.
Right. Okay.
Krypton Factor. That's it.
That's it. Yes.
Oh, Krypton Factor. We're going back a few years now, aren't we? So anyway, I've done the Krypton Factor assault course. And I got to the end of it after doing a 15-mile run or whatever the hell it was. And I was a broken person. You know, I was 19 years old going, I don't know why I've just done this to myself. It's ridiculous. And at the end of it, all of these, you know, girls and guys who are part of what was the Manchester and Salford Officer Training Corps picked me back up, took me to the bar, bought me a pint, and said, this is our club. This is what, this is our family. And I went, oh, I think I could like it here. I was a broken girl, but yeah, you know, they looked after me and they took me under their wing and they took care of me. And I thought, I love being part of something bigger. I love being part of something that's not just about, you know, getting a degree. This is doing something a bit different.
And it's funny that you then ended up doing, as part of your sort of career later on, a role which involved retention and loyalty. Because I'm guessing one of the things that you learned from that whole experience is that concept of loyalty and being in a club and being in a group of people. Do you think there was some, do you think that was intentional? Do you think that was just, you know, it just so happened to, that's where you ended up?
Definitely not intentional. You know that speech, I think it's a Steve Jobs commencement speech that he did with Stanford. Can't remember how long ago it was now, but one of the summaries of the speech was, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only do it looking backwards. And I completely agree with that sentiment. Nothing in my career makes sense when you look at it in the moment looking forward. It only ever makes sense looking backward. Particularly that role, you know, moving back into a commercial role at O2 and looking after the retention and the customer base. I'd never done it before.
Yeah.
I'd actually been a consultant for Capgemini and I was advising them on what they needed to do next. And one of the guys who ran the team, a wonderful guy called Peter Rampling, said to me, so you've written the advice. Do you feel confident enough to come and deliver it? And it was that kind of a challenge of, what are you made of?
Yeah.
Do you want to come? And where's your money? Is it in the same version of where your mouth is? Come and help us make it work. And I'm an absolute sucker for, thank you for reminding us of what the challenge is. Do you want to show us how you're going to do it? Or do you want to prove to us that it's possible? And I'll go, yes.
There seems to be a theme coming through here.
Yeah,
straight away.
I'm quite a simple soul, really, actually, aren't I? I'm quite easy to read. I can't help but not want to try and fix something that somebody says is unfixable. So at the time with O2, they had a customer churn rate of, and by customer churn, I mean the number of customers that they had signed up to their contract base. It was in somewhere close to 30%. So if you've got a contract base, a third of which are leaving you every year.
Yeah.
That's like hemorrhaging people. Yeah. It's not good. And at the time, Vodafone in the UK were global leaders at about 18%. And everybody was going, how do we be Vodafone? How do we do that? How can we do that? And I'd come in as a consultant and obviously consultants are always given this pretty horrible thing of, well, you sold us a strategy, but you know, can you actually deliver it? And that was the challenge that Peter Rampling gave me. And I went, well, all right, then I'll give it a go.
What were some of the key? Because I mean, I can imagine O2. I mean, you know, nobody really loves a telco. I think they've obviously struggled. They all struggle. And that's, I guess, from the UK and Australia. But how did you address that? How do you, when you, you know, day one, you're looking at a 30%, 30% of your customer base leaving every year. What do you do to tackle something like that?
First thing that you realize is very quickly that there is literally no silver bullet. There's no one thing you can do to fix it. You have to accept that this is going to be a slog. It's going to be a couple of years and it's going to take time. The other thing that you need to realize as well is that you're not meant to have all of the answers by yourself. So you need to go out to different parts of the customer experience and figure out where are the most broken points that I can fix quickly, or equally, where are the most simple solutions that I can solve quickly so that I can just, you know, kick a few goals and start getting everybody really motivated to carry on to go and fix the longer term problems. And what I realized really quickly was that the biggest opportunity sat in the call center, which, not a particularly sexy answer to the question. You know, everybody's hoping that you can come up with a marketing solution or a new customer proposition that you can charge them more for less.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen because, you know, you've got millions and millions of customers, so you can't please everybody with one proposition. What you need to do is fix it the other end. So in this example, I literally camped myself up in the call centre for almost the best part of a year and realised that they were the people that had the opportunity to save the customer before they left. So instead of hoping that, you know, everything could be fixed by a proposition up front, I realized that all of this sat with conversation, with speaking to our customers and understanding why they were frankly pissed off or why they were, you know, upset and dealing with it. And what we found was actually our call center could fix most of the problems as long as we gave them the flexibility. So we introduced a different system which gave them maybe up to, depending on the value of the customer, and of course that's always got to be implemented because you've got to make it financially sensible, but we gave them flex and said, here's your window. You could give them £20, or you could give them £100. That's your window. The closer that you can get it towards a midpoint, the better. But if you need to put £100 in to save your customer, go do it. And that empowerment was extraordinary. What we found was that the folks in the call center knew exactly how to save those customers because they spoke to them every day. Yeah. They understand, or they understood what hacked them off, and they put a £50 deal in to save them when they needed to, or they put the £100 in when they needed to. And by giving really smart people who speak to your customers every day the empowerment to save them and give them the flex of that window, we not only saved a chunk more customers, but we were actually more efficient in doing it.
Yeah. Do you know what? I had a conversation probably the last podcast, last masterclass I did with a friend of mine. We talked about giving staff the flexibility to make those decisions, and we were using Southwest Airlines and their the freedom that they give their flight attendants to spice up the, you know, the safety routines, and that any other airlines that would scare the crap out of them, you know, giving staff that kind of leeway. But it's amazing that what happens when you do that and you do it properly, that it can absolutely change your business, as it has done with Southwest Airlines. So
we went from being that 30%, you know, hemorrhaging customers, we went down to 11.
Wow.
In 3 years. Yeah. We became the global leader on how to deal with supporting customers and making sure that they got value and making sure that they didn't ever get to the point where they wanted to leave in the first place. I was really lucky, by the way. It wasn't just all about that particular solution. Like I said, there's no silver bullet. At the same time, O2 in the UK had exclusivity of the iPhone, which obviously in Australia that never happened.
Yeah.
We also had the O2 Arena, which, you know, got turned from this massive white elephant of the Millennium Dome into one of the world's best global concert locations. And, you know, we got tickets that we could give to customers. We did the same with Arsenal Football Club and the England rugby team. We had all of these different assets that we could give to our customers to say, yeah, thank you for being with us, or thank you for putting up with us when we've made a mistake and we apologize for that. But here's our contribution towards saying we're sorry, or saying thank you for being with us for the last 5 years. And what we found was oftentimes it's not just in the price of the product they're buying, that the value comes from feeling recognized.
Yeah, it's spot on. I think that loyalty thing, it doesn't matter what you're giving them. It doesn't matter that, you know, the cost and the price associated with it. It's just the fact that they feel that someone has paid attention to them and is almost speaking to them directly, as opposed to, you know, that they feel that they're chatting to a, you know, a brick wall of a brand. Yeah. So just to sort of take a step back, the other thing I just wanted to touch on was the work that you did with Vodafone, because obviously, you know, I suspect after you moved from Vodafone to O2, even though there was Capgemini in the middle of that, I bet nobody from Vodafone ever spoke to you again, was it? Was it like that sort of love-hate thing between the two brands?
Well, a little bit. So I remember when I you know, sort of eventually made the move from Vodafone to O2, everyone's like, oh, you're going from big red to big blue. I went, they're actually the same. You're right, they're a different colour, but yeah, it's the same company underneath. And later on down the line, maybe 20 odd years later, my brother works for Vodafone. I've got loads of mates that still work for O2. And at the end of the day, I think what you've got to reconcile with is it's not one telco against another or anything like that, and more what difference did you make whilst you were there?
Yeah. Just on your Vodafone stuff, you did some work in that sort of new product development. And I just want to kind of get an understanding of how important you think that is to an average business. Now, obviously, you're in a startup space, so pretty much everybody, the large amount of people you're working with is purely new product development. But do you think there's a place for MPD in every business? Should every business be looking at trying to develop new products?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're not looking at what's happening in the future, then you're not kind of safeguarding your own existence, number one. I think the second part is, if you want to keep really talented people in your company, there are naturally talented people want to be sort of thinking about what's new and how they can make an influence and an impact on your own industry and business. So if you're not careful, then you will lose those great people and you will lose those opportunities to develop your business. So there's some practical consideration of that. I think if I was a leader of any company, though, whether it be a small, medium business or a large global corporate, if you're not thinking about new product development, then you are genuinely almost sort of putting your own business into a category of I don't care what happens to it next.
Yeah.
And I think I've already said, I care about making sure I leave a legacy and making sure that I leave things better than I find them. So by definition, new product development or new people development or new category development within your own sort of industry, it's important to be on that axis. Otherwise, you run the risk of your business not being here in 5 or 10 years' time. And that makes me feel sad. I don't like being on that other side of things to think that, I was a reason why a business didn't or isn't here anymore.
I think you made another good point just there about that new people development, is it doesn't necessarily always have to be about creating new products and things like that, but developing new people and bringing new people to the front of your business is equally as important as developing new products. And I think sometimes when you're in a service-based business, if it's I keep picking on accountants in these podcasts but if you're in a service-based business, sometimes it is hard to produce new products, but it's not hard to be producing new people that can help grow your business.
Absolutely agree with you. And innovation shouldn't just come from product or even people. It can come from process. It can come from a slightly different way that you service your customer. Innovation doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be, I'm Steve Jobs and I've just created the iPod or the iPad. Yeah. I've just created a new category of a thing that never existed before. And all of us are going, wow, I mean, I've got one and I'm glad I have one. And I don't know what I did without it. I get that. Not everybody can think like that. And not everyone should. But what we're all capable of doing in every single thing that we do every day is to figure out, how could I just make this a little bit better? How could I make this a bit more efficient or just slightly less painful? And if that's really what innovation is, it's actually not just the big ticket items. Innovation is what we do every day. How can we make things just that little bit better, a little bit more efficient, that little bit more fun, that little bit more interesting? And if that's what we can do, just that little bit more every day, then that's how we get those big steps towards, sort of innovation in the future. And we should recognize that most of the big steps forward that we've had, certainly in my lifetime and yours, have come from small steps, not the big ones. The small steps are just as relevant.
It's funny you say that, because again, when I look through where you've been, the roles that you've been in, is that none of them seem a massive jump. They don't seem, it doesn't seem like you've leapt from one industry to another industry. Everything seems to be a sensible progression of steps to get you to where you are. Is that how you feel looking back on it?
Like I said, that Steve Jobs speech of looking backwards, the steps look sensible. At the time, they weren't. So the story goes, when I left working in the marketing space for O2 in the UK, I actually went and climbed Kilimanjaro with my dad, my brother and five friends.
Just one weekend. Just went and did that.
I mean, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. So I filled it with climbing a mountain, which is perfectly reasonable.
Fair enough. Seems totally sensible, yeah.
No, it's perfectly reasonable. So anyway, I went off and I climbed the mountain. It was hard and all those different things. And I got to just before the summit of Kilimanjaro and I realised, by the way, I'd got horrible altitude sickness. So I was throwing up every 30, maybe 40 seconds. It was horrible. But there was a part of me that just went, I am not sodding while stopping.
This is there we go. There's the theme coming through this again.
No, I'm not stopping. So I carried on and I carried on and I carried on. And anyway, we got to this part where you could see there's a sign at the top of Kilimanjaro and it says, congratulations, you've reached the roof of Africa. It's 5,495 meters or whatever it is. And it says, you know, it's Uhuru Peak. You've reached it. And you can see that sign from about 300 meters away.
Right.
And I saw the sign and I thought I would get this sort of adrenaline hit of, or I'm going to sprint or, you know, maybe hobble slightly faster. I'm going to get there. And what actually happened was I saw the sign, I sat down and I sobbed. Absolutely sobbed because I realized that in just a few hundred meters' time, the thing that had given me my emotional support, the reason why I was getting up in the morning, would be gone. And I had to go back to a job that I didn't love anymore. And I knew I didn't love it and I hadn't loved it for a long time, but I'd plugged the gap with, let's go climb a mountain.
Yeah.
So I climbed the mountain, kind of got to the top and realized I was not just done because I was kind of spent, but I was done.
Yeah.
I'd done it. And I just couldn't think about going back to my old job. So I texted my boss and I quit.
And I from the top of the mountain?
Yeah. Turns out that there's signal at the top.
Was it O2 up there?
No, it was an African telco, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was carried by O2. And it was a funny moment where I realized, geez, it's up to me to figure out what I want to do with my life. I can't outsource putting a career together and expecting that somebody who's my boss will put the right thing in front of me.
Yeah.
So I'd quit. I had no idea what I was going to do when I got back. The rest of the story, which I've actually not told before, by the way. So here's
I've got an exclusive.
Here's a new one for you. I got back to the UK and O2 at the time sort of rejected my resignation, which I thought was interesting because I thought it was mine to give, not theirs to accept. Anyway, we got to this point and there was this one marketing conference where our marketing director at the time was quite formidable. She's an extraordinary leader, Sally Cowdery, I think, is now at, I don't know where she is now. She used to work for Camelot, so I don't know where she is now, but she's a phenomenal marketer. I learned a huge amount from her. Right. Anyway, we're in this room and we're also at the same time as being at a marketing conference. It's an Apple announcement day. Now, anybody in telco will tell you that when Apple announce a new hardware, whether it be a handset or a laptop, everybody in the telco industry has to just sit there and go, how the hell do we support that? Because they don't tell you anything in advance. So anyway, we sat there going, crap, it's this much money and we didn't expect it was going to be this expensive. And I remember Sally just leant over the table towards me and said, so that customer proposition that you've been working on for the last 9 months, it's probably not going to work out now, is it? And I remember having this slight out-of-body experience where my response was, over my dead body. And I realized at that moment that I no longer cared what my bosses thought of me.
Yeah.
I cared more about doing the right thing. Now, admittedly, as Sally will tell you if she was in the room, I also got a little bit drunk after that and got a bit leery. however... She cut me some slack the following morning and said, you stuck up for the customer. And I thank you for doing that. But I realized quite quickly after that scenario of I was quite willing to put my entire career on the line with this particular leader and go, no, I'm not doing that. And it was quite an interesting moment. So it was a mix of, I knew that I was, you know, no longer personally sort of manifested towards that particular career, but I'd also lost my personal kind of attachment to the customer and the product. And I knew I needed to leave.
Yeah.
I knew I needed to go. And what was, you know, sort of quite paramount to me was I genuinely love work. I love my team. I love what I do. And I always did, even back then, you know, in the telco space. And the fact that I was willing to put my entire career on the line and do something quite so verbally stupid as to tell a leader over my dead body was kind of an interesting moment.
Yeah. I can imagine. That after that, that took you into the accelerator program. So WEIRA and the Muradi programs.
Yep.
And that obviously somewhere along there got you to Australia. What on earth brought you to Australia?
Honestly, serendipity.
Right.
Total luck.
Yeah.
So after that moment, I had my shouting match at Sally, and then I apologized the following morning. The following day, I resigned again and said, look, this is done. I'm quite obviously a bit of a terrorist, and that's not helpful to everybody. So let's just call it what it is.
Yeah.
And I was leaving. And then Telefonica, who owns O2 in the UK, announced that they were going to launch a startup program.
Right.
And the guy that was going to go and be the director of it for Europe just also happened to be a person that knew me quite well from O2 as well. And he just said, look, you're leaving anyway. Come work for me for 6 weeks. If it doesn't work out, no harm done. If it does, then we can have a conversation. 18 months later, I was head of operations for the whole of Europe for that entire program for Telefonica. And we had 7 accelerators across Europe. It was so extraordinary. I loved every second of it.
Yeah.
I wasn't even remotely looking at another job. And a person who was one of the mentors in the program in London said, look, a mate of mine's visiting from overseas. Can you do a tour? So my usual tour is about 15, 20 minutes. And I do a tour around the accelerator. And I usually introduce people to one or two startups. So I did that. And at the end of it, I said, by the way, who are you and what do you do? And he said, my name's Rick Ellis and I run all things media for Telstra. And at which point, I reminded myself that I love Australia deeply and I'd always wanted to work here, particularly Sydney.
Yeah.
And went, oh, okay, that's interesting. Is there any particular reason why you're here? And he said, well, Telstra's looking at running or launching something similar. Do you know anybody that might be interested in helping us out? At which point I ripped off my metaphorical arm and smacked him around the head and said, pick me.
Yes. and here you are.
That's how I ended up.
And
so that was, by the way, that was a conversation that happened, let's call it day one. 3 weeks later, I came over to Sydney for interviews. And 2 months after that, I moved.
Wow.
Happened very, very quickly.
Yeah. What? And do you know what? I could probably sit here and talk. There's about 1,000 questions I have for you throughout that time. I just want to get an understanding of, I mean, obviously in that time with WEIRA and, you know, on all the other organizations you've been involved with, you see a lot of startups. What if a startup walked in front of you today and said, you know, what's your advice, Annie? What's the first things that we need to do? Are there some things that you just go, you know, there's boxes that have to be checked before you take a business seriously or a startup seriously?
Yes, actually. There's like probably 3 things I look for. So the first thing I look for is, what's your association to the problem that you're trying to solve?
Right.
And the reason why I mention that is you could get slightly excited about Bitcoin right now, for example, or maybe artificial intelligence or machine learning, because all of those sort of things are quite, you know, kind of hot topics in the startup space. But if you don't care about why you're trying to solve that problem, other than, you know, the potential of becoming $1 million or $1 billion founder, then when it gets hard, you're probably going to tap out.
Yeah.
As a mentor or an investor, I want to invest in people who are in it for the long haul just as much as I am. So first thing is, how wedded to the problem that you're trying to solve, are you? And that can become, that can actually come from a, I've spent 5 years in this industry. I've seen people banging their heads against this wall for so long, and I just want to fix it, right through to a family member or a friend has suffered from cancer, or just as a personal kind of affiliation to the problem. It doesn't always have to be a business reason. It can also be a personal reason. The next thing is, I want to see founders who are flexible enough to accept feedback and humble enough to realize that they don't know everything, whilst have a genuine belligerence of, do you know what? I know that's what you've just told me, but I'm going to go do it anyway.
Yeah.
And that is that's a horrible / impossible balance to try and reconcile, because by the definition of it, yeah, you don't know how to tell someone to be belligerent. And also, you can be a belligerent idiot. You can be a belligerent, wonderful person, but you can also be the idiot at the same time. So that one's a hard one to try and navigate through. And most times it comes down to the emotional intelligence of the founder. And then the last one, and this sounds dull as everything that I could possibly tell you in your entire life, but if you can't run a business, if you can't figure out how to make sure that your dollars are going to get you from the end of today to the end of tomorrow or the end of next month or the end of next year, it doesn't matter how good your idea is, because it just won't last. Yeah. So you know, you can be the most exciting individual, wonderful leader and founder, but if you can't turn this into a genuine business, all bets are off. So there's the balance of, I want you to be wedded to the problem. I want you to be inspiring and also, you know, slightly belligerent but humble. But I also want you to be able to manage the cash flow.
Do you know what? You've probably just picked my three problems from the past, my own personal problems from the past 6 or 7 years. And I think number three was such a, I think number three is such a vital one. One that I've seen. Some people who come to, you know, I've met with ideas and they've got no idea. And one of the things I often say is you don't necessarily have to run it, be able to understand how to run a business, but you then have to have the humility or the acceptance of hiring someone or working with someone who can do it for you. Because if you're no good with that sort of side of things, understanding cash flow and those kind of things, you need to have people with you that are good at those kind of things. And I think I beat myself up about that all the time for the past sort of 7 or 8 years, because those are things that I should have picked up on. But
it's the part of it that isn't most exciting, right? It's not making the vision become bigger and better.
Yeah.
It's dull, right?
Yeah.
Filing your taxes every year, it's fucking dull. No one wants to do it. But it has to be done, because if you don't do it, then you don't get to go and do the next big thing. And I get it. I understand that it's literally the thing that you would never want to do in a million years. But if you don't do it, then you don't get to do the next big thing. And I think a lot of founders get quite sort of the old magpie syndrome of, oh, it's the new shiny thing over there and I want to go and do that next. You have to earn the right to go and do that. You don't go and do it because it's the next shiny thing. You earn the right to do it. And I think if I could give any advice to any particularly young founder right now, it would be earn the right to do what you want to do. Don't expect it to come on a silver platter. There's no entitlement in this industry. You have to earn the right. So if that means you're doing a couple of years or 6 months of interning in somebody else's company, maybe in a vision that you don't necessarily completely align with in the long haul, but you're going to learn a crap ton of stuff that you can apply to your own idea, go do that. There is no bad thing by learning those skills in somebody else's idea and somebody else's business so that you can actually turn those skills to your own. We all need to cut our teeth on something. You're not going to be an expert from day one. So go learn the skills and then bring it back.
I think there's also there's learnings there for people who've been running businesses for 20 years. I think, you know, you talk about that point number three is that you've got to understand how your business makes money. I work with a guy who consults in the restaurant space, and and he's consulted with restaurants that he's walked into, and the, you know, the restaurant's been has literally made no money for 15 to 20 years. And by no money, I mean it's broken even every year. You know, so everybody gets paid their salary and the owners get paid their salary for working in the business, but it's never gone beyond that. And I think whether you're starting, I think whether it's day one in a business or it's day 15 years, that if you can sit there and go, hold on a second, I need to understand how we go from breaking even for the past 15 years to year number 16, making, you know, 15% profit. Mm. It's such a, you know, it's such a key lesson for businesses that sit there and, you know, don't understand the numbers. At least have somebody explain the numbers to you so that you comprehend it all, at least on the surface.
And the other thing is, you know, understanding on the surface, but understanding the trends. So what are your levers? If you do X and, you know, it goes down 20%, you do Y and it goes up 20%, then obviously do more Y. I think the part of that that also is really interesting is what are the different experiments that you're making along the way so that you can understand if I do A, B, and C and it ends up with X, Y, and Z, at least I know that if I need to make a tiny bit more profit, then I know, yeah, maybe selling more desserts in the restaurant is where I go, or selling dessert wine is where I go, or, you know, just knowing what your levers are as a business owner is so important.
The funny thing is with the restaurant business, it's often those levers are just things like starting the staff or a couple of the members of the staff an hour later, or getting them to finish an hour earlier, or things like that. And adding those levers and pulling those levers makes a huge amount of difference. And then when you look at that compared to other businesses, you go, well, what could you offshore? What could you, you know, send overseas and get done for $6 an hour that you might be paying $30 an hour for here? It's not rocket science, but I know for some people and some business owners, it does appear, it feels like it's rocket science.
What you've just described, though, is you're breaking things down to small or smaller problems than the largest one at the top. So if the big number, and you know, going back to my O2 days, my constant challenge was save £50 million. My balance sheet, the customer base at the time, was £700 million. So say 50 million out of 700 sounds easy, right? It's not, by the way.
No, it doesn't.
It's actually really hard.
No, it does sound hard.
But what you do is you clip, you know, £5 here and another £5 there, and it all adds up. And then I never got to 50 million. I always got to about 28 or 30.
Yeah.
And I'd go, if you want the 50, I can give you that, but here's the consequence. What I understood was what my levers were. I understood if I went too far, what the consequence would be of pushing it. So I would maybe, I can save you the 50 million, but here's what the cost will be next year, because we'll have had a 5% extra churn rate, which will mean that the balance sheet next year is, you know, down by, you know, 15 million in revenue.
Yeah.
So you have to be as a leader of a business, you have to be completely on top of all of your numbers so that you can articulate, here's the reason why we can't go any further, because the impact of what we're trying to do is going to have a much bigger impact on the business in years 2, 3, and 4. And as a leader, what your job really is to make sure that the people who are really making the decisions have all of the facts.
I'm going to put you on the spot here now, because one of the things I like to hear makes me sound like some sort of sadist, but at times when you've done something or you've failed at something or it hasn't gone according to plan, and something that you look back on and go, crap, I could have done that a lot better. Is there anything that sort of stands out to you in that sort of in career path?
Hell yeah. I mean, earlier this year, I stood on a stage on the 1st of December, literally this time last year, in Barangaroo here in Sydney, and said, I'm going to launch a new startup hub and it's going to be the best thing ever and all this sort of stuff. And about 4 months after I announced it, I had to then do a mea culpa and go, oops, it's not going to happen. I actually got on the front cover of the AFR with that statement.
Wow.
In December last year. And we're now, what, December, a year later?
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. And it's a very public failure.
What did you learn from that? What have you done differently? Just not said it?
You know what? No, I wouldn't have done a damn thing differently, if I'm honest. at least I put front and center what I really wanted to do. Yeah. It didn't work out. And it's not because I'm not a good person or I'm a complete fool and it all, you know, sort of disintegrated because I didn't manage it well. But life happens and choices happen around you and you can't always be in control of everything. But I'm also quite pragmatic. I recognized that, you know, when another option came along, which, you know, in the end, New South Wales government decided to sponsor a startup hub instead. And I went, you know what, that's a great answer. So I'm not going to try and spend the next, you know, 4 years of my life to try and make mine better or different. I'm just going to go, fine.
Yeah.
Great idea. I'll stop what I'm doing whilst it might be publicly humiliating to confess that I failed at something inside of 6 months of launching it. But the right answer is that founders are still being helped and that there's still going to be a home for startups in Sydney. And I just focused on the greater good. So I did this, you know, sort of public blog post earlier this year in June or July going, I failed and I feel, you know, publicly humiliated, but whatevs, at least I tried. And the interesting response I got from that was, no, you did try and well done for that. And nobody feels, or on the majority of what I saw and what I read from the post, the majority of this, the sentiment was, yeah, shit, you know, you gave it a good go. So what's wrong with that? And it was kind of interesting because I felt really personally like I'd failed, but when I shared that with, you know, the wider public and with folks from the startup ecosystem, everybody's like, it's all good.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Yeah.
And what you realize when something feels like a personal failure or feels like a, you know, something that you're going to have to kind of doff your cap at for the next 5 years going, really sorry, I'm really sorry, I'm really sorry. You realize quite quickly that no one cares. It's your own thing that you're carrying. It's no one else's.
Yeah. I made a lot of mistakes in the past sort of, you know, 8-9 years, and I actually wrote a blog post about it as well. It's quite healing to sit there and go, you know what, here's all the things that I've done wrong and here's what I've learned from them. And, you know, you wouldn't have changed. I mean, I probably would have changed a few things, but it's quite a good process to get that out and, you know, accept what happened and learn and grow from it.
Absolutely. And I think in quite a lot of cases with that kind of, I did something and it didn't quite work out the way I planned, it's actually yours. It's no one else's.
Yeah.
There's no sort of external body that's kind of doing a critique on what you did and what you didn't do. For the most part, you know, unless you're in government, of course, then that's, you know, all bets are off. But in this scenario, you know, if you're doing something that's helping people and it didn't quite work out and your intentions were quite true and clear at the beginning, literally nobody has a problem with that. And I think as long as you start from a good place of, I'm just trying to help and I'm trying to do things that might make things better for founders and for the ecosystem, you can't really fail. Even if you do, you can't really, because everybody recognizes that you were doing it for the right reasons from the get-go.
If you're in the US, that failure is obviously normally a badge of, a badge of pride. A lot of people are saying, you know, that was my alarm that's going from my car in the background. That's very professional. He said he should have turned that one off. But yeah, it's worn as a badge of pride, that failure.
Not really failure, is it? Because failure in that sense is something didn't quite work out and I've learned from it. And I think, you know, any other country in the world still struggles, or most countries in the world struggle with things not quite working out perfectly.
Yeah.
And we just as human beings need to get much better at the idea that we don't have all the answers. And particularly in this day and age where everything is changing at such a rapid pace, nobody can predict the future anymore, and nobody should expect that. You know, we're not in a particular part of society, you know, sort of history where the step changes are small and incremental. The step changes are massive.
Yeah.
So we have to, you know, sort of accept that we can't predict what that looks like. And some of us might every now and again that prediction right, but for the most part, we're going to get it wrong, and that's okay.
We're going to have to sadly wind this up, because you and I could probably talk about anything in this space for a couple of hours.
I think we could.
But I'm going to wind up with my last three questions. I want to understand brands that excite you, that get you interested. And trust me, we've had everything here from, you know, big international global brands to toilet paper. So you don't have to pick.
I think I know what the toilet paper one is. I think that's going to be Who Gives a Crap.
No, do you know? It didn't start off as that, but it has. Well, I've had a couple of people that have picked toilet paper that they quite like, and one of them was Who Gives a Crap. But there was
I get associated with companies that have a purpose. So I want to work with people who want to change the world, even if the changing of the world is just in a small way.
Yeah.
My favorite one at the moment is a company that I've just ordered toothbrushes from. And the toothbrushes are made from wood, balsa wood or bamboo. And yeah, the bristles are made from another renewable substance. So why should toothbrushes always be made of plastic?
Yeah.
We throw them away, they become, you know, something that goes and sits in the ocean for goodness knows how long, but my current toothbrushes don't.
Oh.
They degrade and, you know, become part of the earth from which they were originally made. My personal, you know, sort of association with anything like that is we should be, as consumers, much better at choosing things that we know solve the problem that we need to at the time, whilst not buggering up the planet that we live on.
Yeah.
It seems sensible and you know, when I say it like that, you know, you just giggled a little bit because it's obvious, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
How many times do you go into a coffee shop and you still use the disposable cup?
Yeah, absolutely.
How many times do you go in and you go, you know what, I've got 5 minutes of my life. I can have that coffee in a normal coffee cup and I can drink it, and then I'll give it back to them and they can wash it and it can be used by the next person. 5 minutes of your life has just saved the planet a few more inches of resource. My brands that I love are the ones where we realize if we just take five more seconds of the choice of my consumership, that the world is a tiny bit better.
Yeah.
Goes back to the same thing that we were talking about earlier, that the, you know, diversity and inclusion and things like that, they don't get fixed by one tiny thing. They get fixed by lots and lots of small things done repetitively.
Yeah.
Fixing the world is going to take an awful lot of work. So let's do it lots and lots of small steps at a time. So go find brands like the Who Gives a Craps of this world, where you can buy toilet roll that is completely, you know, sort of recyclable and made from renewable resources, the same as the toothbrush I just mentioned, and you can go and find any number of hundreds of them online. Go do that.
What was the toothbrush you were recommending there?
Do you know what? I actually can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head. Whilst we carry on talking, though, I'm going to go upstairs and go and remind myself. So what were your other two questions?
Well, I was going to say, well, you could also, if you tell me afterwards, what we'll do is we'll put it in the show notes. And then if anybody wants to look it up, we can, or even better, we'll share it on our Instagram as well. Not that we have thousands of people on the Instagram, but we'll do it as a personal recommendation from you on the Instagram.
Awesome.
Last two questions. What's next for you? Where are you going in 2018? What's going to be big for you? And no need to promise things that don't happen in 6 months here. But
so 2018 for me, it's not something new. 2018 for me is a continuation of one of the themes that we started this year around diversity and inclusion. We started this year with the same-sex marriage debate and supporting LGBTI community with Fishburners. We changed our logo. We adopted the rainbow, and And I thought, gosh, that's a really nice thing to do, and it's going to be a simple thing. But a couple of the things that happened on the back of it were really quite surprising. So the first thing was the amount of the LGBTI community that were already in Fishburners just were massively moved and you know, sort of found me out and cried on my shoulder or gave me a massive hug going, thank you for doing that. Thank you for making us finally feel welcome. And my question back was, did you not feel welcome before? I mean, I didn't think that Fishburners or anywhere else in the startup community really in Australia was openly anti what you were doing. He said, no, it was more that you did it and you openly did it without asking.
Yeah.
You openly did this for us and now we feel included because you said our names. And that was, wow, I had no idea. And I, whilst I, you know, I'm a woman in the tech community, so I'm in a version of a minority, but I'm still a white woman in the tech community. So I'm still in a position of privilege in comparison to other groups. Sometimes that is a real smack in the face where you realize that the privilege that you're born with, you often don't remember how much it makes a difference. So I've taken that lesson quite, like I say, a bit of a smack in the face. There's a lot to do. And whether you're, you know, from the LGBTI community, we have very much more to continue making them feel included, whether it's a person of color, an Indigenous Australian, just there's so many more things to do for us to make sure that we have genuine diversity within our community. So that's not just a 2018 issue. I think that's going to become a bit of a piece of work to do for the next sort of 5 years. Certainly a big thing for next year, though. I think the next thing is, how do we capitalize on the fact that we've now got great innovation hubs in Brisbane? We're about to have this big, you know, sort of startup hub launch here in Sydney in early next year. You know, how do we use that as a kicking off point? And if I look at examples of Tel Aviv and London, yeah, that when Shoreditch happened and when Tel Aviv first started, you know, sort of bubbling under as being a really great tech innovation system a good 15 years ago, it wasn't just they built a hub and their job was done. It was they built a hub and then they kicked on. Yeah. So I think Australia's got a big kicking on thing to do in the next sort of couple of years' time. And it's great that Brisbane's got the precinct and the Capitol building in the CBD. It's great that Sydney's going to have this startup hub launching in Wynyard at the beginning of next year. But that's just two or three locations in two cities. That's not enough. We need to keep going. And of course, startups need a place to grow to. So even if you're starting in the precinct or the Capitol building in Brisbane or over here down at Wynyard in Sydney, you still need a place to grow to. Who's going to help you be your first customer or help become your first, you know, significant investor? All of those sort of things need to grow at the same pace. And I just hope that the Australian government's ready to grow at the same pace as the ecosystem is. And I think that's going to be a bit of a challenge.
Final question. If anybody's got questions for you or they want to get in contact or they want to just, you know, ask you a question about business and startups, where's the best place for them to find you? And for God's sake, don't give out your phone number.
Oh, I'm not that foolish.
No, I was going to say.
My DMs are open on Twitter. Okay. That's probably the best place to find me. So Annie_Parker, have at it on Twitter. Come have a chat to me. You can try and link in with me on LinkedIn. I look at that sometimes, but the best place is Twitter.
Brilliant. Thank you very, very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Some fantastic insights there. And I think anybody listening to that should get at least sort of three or four really good gems of you know, things that they could apply to their business. And I think it's all businesses, not just startups, that I think could learn.
No, and that's probably my closing comment to you, if it's okay. If I can give you one more snippet. I started as a management consultant, ended up in marketing at, you know, a telco, and have now ended up in what I think is the best place for me and most exciting place. But I could never have predicted that from my degree to where I am now, 20 odd years later. Nobody knows what your path might be. there is no common sense structure to a career anymore. If you want to go and do something, just find a way to go do it. You will be surprised at how much you can achieve by just taking that first step.
Once again, thank you very much. And it's been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure as well.
I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Thank you very much for listening in. Once again, I just want to say a few thank yous. Firstly, to the man who helps put all this together, Gilberto from We Love Sound. You can find him at welovesound.audio. Also, I'd like to thank Patrick and Eddie, of course, for their ongoing support and ideas and banter. And finally, I'd just like to thank you guys. If you could write a review or give us a rating on iTunes, we would absolutely love that. That would be really appreciated by us. And if you'd like to follow us, we are on Instagram. If you'd like to talk to me, I have my own website, obviously, and Twitter, LinkedIn. You can find me in all those places. Until next week, we'll see you soon.